Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, May 17, 2021. The time is 1:36 p.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Schauer, Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and myself, Chair Senator Holland. I welcome Senator Begich to the committee meeting today. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Jeannie, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. The only item on today's calendar is House Bill number 105, a governor's bill related to the detention of minors. This is the first hearing of House Bill 105 in the Senate, although the related bills, Senate Bill 91 and Senate Bill 99, previously passed from the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. Senate Bill 91 also moved through Senate State Affairs. We're joined today by Tracy Dompling and Matt Davidson from the Division of Juvenile Justice via Teams. Ms. Dompling, am I pronouncing that correctly? Would you care to speak on House Bill 105?
Yes, thank you, Chair Holland. You are stating it correctly. Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Tracy Dompling, and I'm the director for the Division of Juvenile Justice in the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for the opportunity to present on HB 105 today, a bill that brings Alaska into compliance with federal law and addresses both long identified and newly emerging statutory issues related to juvenile justice. HB 105 updates Alaska statute with recent changes to the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, hereafter referred to as the JJDPA. The JJDPA is the primary piece of federal legislation that guides juvenile justice practices around the country. Lack of compliance with the JJDPA will lead to grant penalties on the division's major federal grant. Without HB 105, DJJ will be subject to a 20% reduction to our Title II grant, which is about $80,000 for federal fiscal year 21, and we will be penalized each year moving forward if not in compliance. HB 105 requires that minors who have been waived into the adult criminal justice system be held in juvenile facilities until they're age 18. Currently, minors who are subject to auto waiver or discretionary waiver statutes are held in adult jails and correctional facilities in Alaska. This bill is limited in scope and intentionally does not have any impact on the crimes or sentences of minors who are subject to waiver into the adult justice system, nor will this bill have any fiscal impact. If implemented, the bill will improve the conditions of confinement for minors that are currently held in adult facilities. Minors can be difficult to manage in adult facilities and are often held in segregation units. To accomplish this, the bill will require the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services to develop agreements about the holding of minors who are in DOC custody, who've been waived, but to have them in our juvenile facilities with a Division of Juvenile Justice. According to the Department of Corrections, today there are approximately 6 minors in DOC facilities who have been charged with auto waiver offenses. There's also a bulk of this bill for 105 that has conforming updates to the definitions of DJJ facilities and staff. These definitions have a real impact on our work as well as youth safety. The bill also makes changes to criminal statute after a case against a former DJJ employee resulted in acquittal of sexual abuse after the lack of an updated definition of DJJ staff as, quote, for position of authority. In addition, HB 105 adds DJJ staff to the list of mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. In closing, we just appreciate the governor's support on this important legislation, as well as the cooperation of the Department of Corrections, Public Safety, and Law in the development of this proposal. The Senate Health and Social Services Committee made important changes to the Senate companion of HB 105, SB 91, that are reflected in this version of HB 105 before you today. So thank you all for your consideration of this important bill. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have now or after Matt Davidson provides a quick summary of key bill sections.
Thank you, Director Dompling. Are there any questions from the committee for Director Dompling? I do plan on taking public testimony shortly. So we do have Matt Davidson from Division of Juvenile Justice via Teams. Did he have any comments on House Bill 105?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I was planning to do a quick identify some key sections that I wanted to draw the committee's attention to. So a quick sectional summary. I know the committee received a written summary.
If you'd please begin. Place yourself on the record and begin.
For the record, my name is Matt Davidson. I'm a social services program officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Thank you to the committee for coming together to hear this bill, and special thank you to our legislative liaison, Suzanne Cunningham, for her tireless work on behalf of this bill. I'm just going to give a summary of the major components included in this bill. Detention of minors, as you summarized, Mr. Chairman, passed out of the House and Social Services Committee with good amendments, and then also passed out of State Affairs. SB 99, which we call the DJJ definitions bill, was heard and passed out of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. The detention of minors bill brings Alaska into compliance with the JJDPA, as the director mentioned. The major components, the major sections of that bill are Section 14, which instructs the Department of Corrections to enter into agreements with DHSS to hold minors who are waived into the adult system in DJJ facilities and juvenile facilities. Section 17 updates the court findings and timing necessary for non-delinquent minors. These are minors who are often runaways, often in OCS custody, and sometimes a court needs to hold them temporarily in DJJ facilities pending another placement. So that's another part of the JJDPA. Section 22 and 25 of the bill update the auto waiver and discretionary waiver statutes with a reference to the new practice of holding waived minors in DJJ facilities. Section 26 adds a new subsection in DJJ statute dealing with the holding of waived minors in DJJ facilities and detailing the limited circumstances and processes that allow for the exemptions to the new rule of holding all minors in DJJ facilities. Sections 40 and 41 detail that court records related to waived minors are not considered confidential. That amendment was made in the House Health and Social Services Committee at the request of the court. And Section 41 authorizes the division to share important information about waived minors under our confidentiality statute. And that's the summary of the definition, the detention of minors bill. The definitions bill, as the director noted, updates the terms and definitions of DJJ staff and facilities. The new definitions are actually found in sections 44 through 46. The bulk of the bill is conforming changes to reflect those changes. The most dramatic update is the term used in the definition of a position of authority in related to the sexual abuse of a minor. That's Section 6 of the bill. A former DJJ staff was acquitted of sex abuse of a minor because the statute, the definition of position of authority, didn't clearly specify that DJJ staff were in that position, and even though he formerly supervised a youth that he engaged in sex abuse with. This bill also adds DJJ staff to mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. That's Section 55. And then the bill also makes updates to important DJJ statutes and codifies best practices and correct some drafting errors from previous legislation related to driver's licenses, underage drinking, and a few other minor issues that just are best practices for the division and do not have any impact on our work. That's the summary, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the division on one of those, I think you call them drafting errors. The minor consuming tickets, it looks like the policy call here to fix a drafting problem in the past is to take all of those into adult court rather than to treat them like other, you know, very relatively minor things, or shoplifting or something, which is handled through the DJJ process. What was it? Why would the decision to treat those in open court rather than through your usual confidential process?
Senator Keel, through the chair, it appears that we're changing the process, but actually what is being added back into what we call provisions inexplicable, or in, excuse my word, language, in the section of the bill is actually codifying the current practice related to underage drinking. The division does not have authority currently over underage drinking, and in 2016, the legislature passed a bill, SB 165, which actually changed the rules and really codified that underage drinking was a district court offense, and that no offenses dealing with underage drinking are referred to the Division of Juvenile Justice. Prior to that, we had one offense called habitual minor consuming, which was referred to the Division of Juvenile Justice. And in 2016, we removed that practice. At that time, the section that looks like it's being added back to our statute was removed accidentally. The current practices are not changing under the bill. We do not currently have any authority over underage drinking.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's going to be a few here, and I can roll with you as you want to let other members on. There's several things, but first thing on the record is it sounds really weird to hear myself very loud all of a sudden. I've realized that's because we're not wearing these things anymore. It did not sound right. Noted. So there is this splitting of two issues. One of these would be a new standalone bill, so we'll just get on the record now, that is going to be introduced next year, which is going to take care of an issue that we had with the bill, which was going to be those below 16 that were the most serious offenders and whether they were prepared and bringing those back into the juvie population beyond that. That's not to be addressed now because it's going to be done later, but it's on the record. We've talked about it. We know it's there, and it's going to be addressed later. The other one, I have some questions when we get to page 12 of the bill, and the first one would be talking about the term reasonable cause versus reasonable suspicion. Where does the reasonable cause come from? Is it a new term and or is it defined in statute? If one of them can answer that, please. For whoever.
Which line is reasonable
cause? That is going to be on
page 12.
Yeah, page 12. Stand by. Let me go get it. Line 18.
Line 18.
And then you can go down to line 22 and see instead of probable cause, you're going to have reasonable cause as opposed to where's my reasonable? I got to go back and find that. And I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to keep up with this because, like I said, this all broke today. So staff has been working through this. And it's the question about suspicion over reasonable cause, line 22 versus reasonable suspicion. So could they give us an update on the why it's worded that way?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Schauer. So the language in Section 17 is what you're referring to. Is directly mirrors the federal language related to the detention of what we call status offenders, and that's those rare cases when most likely a runaway from OCS custody is putting themselves in danger, and so the department goes to a court and asks for a warrant for their arrest to protect them, basically, and part of that warrant authorizes law enforcement to take them temporarily to a DJJ facility pending another non-secure placement. So the language that is included here is actually directly out of the federal act that was amended in 2018, and we mirrored that language. So I can't take ownership for the differences between reasonable suspicion and reasonable cause. The thinking is that law enforcement would, you know, there's an actual arrest warrant for these runaways. They're not they haven't committed a crime a delinquent offense. They are a runaway and they can't be and generally they are not arrested or held in detention. But in this case, these rare cases, and I think the director, we find that we have about five of these cases a year that we report to the feds every year. And so it's a really rare case where the Office of Children's Services is looking for a runaway and they get a court to issue an arrest warrant for them.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. This is a follow-up answer, and then the second question that will lead into the possibility of the amendment to this, a conceptual amendment. So just to be clear on the record, we'll now have probable cause, reasonable suspicion, and reasonable cause in our statutes, which didn't exist before. Is that correct?
I can't speak to Mr. Chairman. I cannot speak to the other locations in statute where those phrases could have been used. Again, this is not in a criminal statute. This is in this 4710-141 is in child protection statute. So it is not a criminal proceeding we're talking about here. This is a civil proceeding in child protection statute, China statute. But I can't speak to other locations those terms might be used.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then the follow-up question for this, the drafting.
Follow-up question.
Thank you. And this one goes to the heart of the splitting this off into some separate issue. On page 12 again, as you go down the list in section 17, so you get to line 20, 22, 24, 27, and 30. At the end of each one, to make it simple, it's not as complicated as it sounds, is adding an and in those at the end of each sentence. Talking with the administration, they believe the semicolon means an and, but they believe the word and should be added on there, just a drafting error. So in conversations with them, I'm happy to debate it. They believe we should have an amendment and a conceptual amendment to add the word and after each of those semicolons. But I believe we have perhaps somebody from Ledge Legal with something different. I don't know. So there you go, Mr. Chairman. But maybe we want to make sure we've got that right before we go down that process, and I offer this as an amendment.
Brief at ease. I believe we have Claire Radford online from Legislative Legal. Ms. Radford, if you can hear me, please state your name and let us know. Did you hear the last question?
Thank you. This is Claire Radford from Ledge Legal for the record. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I did not hear the last question. If you could please have Senator Schauer repeat that for me.
Senator Schauer, the last question regarding House Bill 105, page 12.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. It's more of a comment than a question, I guess, but I guess it's both. So, Claire, on page 12 in section 17, if you look at the end of every sentence for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you have a semicolon, and the suggestion was, or the debate that was happening in office between us and others and the administration was, do we need to add the word and after the semicolon? They believe it's intended to be so, but for clarifying language and thought that maybe it was left out accidentally by the drafters, do we need to go ahead and put the and in? So we're considering a conceptual amendment or not, depending on what the answer is. Hope that makes sense, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Radford, please state your name, your affiliation, and offer any input.
Again, this is Claire Radford from Ledge Legal. Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I believe that with the way that this is drafted, and is implied here, but for the sake of clarity, you could add it on line 30 after court to make sure that it's clear in the statute that that is what is intended.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Schauer.
At the end of the day in the discussion, they said if nothing, all the rest of them would be acceptable, but probably the and on the last one was the most, I don't know what the right word is, but the most important to add as an and, so perhaps we just have a conceptual amendment for that one word at the end. I'm seeing a lot of head shakes, like yes.
Do we have anyone from the room that would like to come forward to the table and speak? Or just give the head shakes?
I'll see via head shake.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, Legislative Liaison, Department of Health and Social Services. And we did discuss this clarification with Senator Schauer and his staff today, and the department believes that it makes sense to have this additional clarification so that it is very clear that an order that's issued under 4710-141K must include items 1 through 6.
So to understand, in its current form, it's correct.
And as Ms. Through the chair, And as Ms. Radford pointed out, the adding the last and after the semicolon on line 30 would just provide an additional level of clarification.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Senator Schauer, prepare yourself for that conceptual.
I can roll with it, Mr. Chair.
All right. I also believe I have Nancy Mead from the Alaska court system who may be able to speak to probable versus reasonable, the probable versus reasonable cause issues. Ms. Mead, if you can hear me, please state your name.
In the room.
Oh, hey, Ms. Mead.
That's one of the head nods.
Ms. Mead, if you can hear me. please state your name and begin providing any input you may have on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I concur with the prior statements that were made with regard to the word and. With respect to probable cause versus reasonable cause, I think that those are very minor differences, and I would say that this Section 17, it does include two different standards, the finding of probable cause that the court would have to make if a runaway child who was in the custody of the Office of Children's Services and did run away. These different findings that the court would have to make, I think, are very closely aligned findings. I recognize the point through the chair that Senator Schauer made with respect to having probable cause and reasonable cause. It is my sense that the court would be able to apply those and consider them to be very closely aligned. The difference would probably make very little difference in any determination that was made. So there are two different words, but in my opinion, those would not make significant or any difference at all to the court's findings that it must make under this provision.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. Any questions? Senator Hughes?
And so what would that difference, that slight difference be between probable and reasonable?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, you probably heard me not being too entirely clear about that. I think it is, at most it's minuscule. So probable cause is the finding that somebody makes in order to effectuate an arrest usually. So you have to have something that gives the law enforcement officer cause to believe that criminality has occurred or is about to occur. That's kind of the typical probable cause, and that's what the court would be doing here. Let's see if the minor is indeed a runaway. It's a minimal finding, basically, and violated a court order. It would maybe a slightly elevated finding that needed to be made for reasonable cause to believe that they violated it, underpinned by more findings by the court. Again, I know that isn't terribly articulate, but I feel, who cares how I feel, but reasonable cause is just slightly a notch above probable cause is what I would conclude.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I just have a foundational question about these foster children who are running away. Are all foster children court ordered to be in foster homes? And so if there were ever a bad situation, I mean, sometimes the child might be running away because they have parents that are good and trying to set parameters, and the child is like, no, I don't want that. So the child runs away. But sometimes there could be something bad happening in the home, and the child's trying to get away from it. And now we're arresting that child, where if you have a child that's not in a foster home, a child who, you know, natural parents living with their natural parents, they run away, they're not arrested. So I'm just curious if all foster children are court ordered to be in the home, and secondly, if the foster child who runs away is arrested for their own safety, as these 1 through 6 things describe, is that cleared from their record, particularly if it's a situation they're fleeing because it's not maybe a safe situation in the foster home? I just hate for that foster child to have a record where a natural child might not, if they run away. It doesn't seem very fair that the foster child would have an arrest on the record and the natural child wouldn't.
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, all of these children, first of all, would be under 18, so that they would, their records would not be public in any manner because they're underage, they're minors. This is such a rare situation. This would only come up if the child would already have to be in a court case, a child in need of aid case. And in that situation, if the child runs away And it comes to the attention of OCS because foster parents call and say we no longer have the child who we were ordered to care for. OCS then, in practicality, makes a determination. What do they do? They do not immediately go to the court and ask for an arrest warrant. So I think, as the administration mentioned, there's a handful of these a year, maybe five or six. And those would be cases that you could conclude OCS only goes to the court and asks for help because there's some underlying problem that OCS is aware of. For example, a minor is a chronic runaway or has some difficulty adhering to court orders in a longstanding and sort of manner that makes OCS think there is nothing we can do with this underage person except put them in McLaughlin, for example, for 7 days. It's a maximum of 7 days. So, I would also assume, were I in your chair, that OCS is only going to pursue this remedy if the minor has other indicia of unreliability, perhaps a criminal record, or perhaps something that causes OCS to think, I need the court's help with this, because as you're probably aware, minors do leave foster homes for various purposes and might go to Covenant House and might have reasons for leaving that, you know, we can only imagine. But all of those kids don't come to the court and ask, and OCS doesn't seek an arrest warrant to have them detained for 7 days. So I think I understand your concern. I would say that this is a procedure that's only used exceedingly rarely.
And I believe, Director Dumpling, did you have something to offer?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I just want to add, as Ms. Mead said, this is a very rare instance, and I think because it is a violation to have non-delinquent minors in secure facilities, the JJRA or JJDPA already had standards that were required that are in statute. What the JJDPA did was actually put even more stringent guidelines on circumstances under which those minor children, that are non-delinquent, their status offenders, that they can be held in DJJ facilities. And yes, Ms. Mead is correct. It is, I think, last fiscal year or the last three fiscal years, we've only seen five youth each year that have been held in such a manner.
Thank you, Director Dumpling. Senator Hughes?
And this is somewhat related to another question I think is going to be for Mr. Davidson, because now we have in a DJJ facility, we have a non-delinquent runaway, but we also can have, in order to align with the new federal laws, now minor who's been charged as an adult until they're age 18 is going to be a DJJ facility. So we have quite the range. And so somebody charged as an adult, let's just say it might be someone who's committed a murder. So in this DJJ facility, you have someone who's committed a murder. You also have a runaway who we're trying to figure out how we're going to handle this and where we're going to place them next. So quite the range. And I'm just wondering about how that might work and also the security of the DJJ facility as far as having someone as dangerous as a murderer in it. Is it as secure as one of our adult correctional facilities? I have the sense it's not, and I'm just concerned about the safety of all the residents at that time if you have an underage serious felon.
Through the chair to Senator Hughes. So just to kind of add to that, right now we do occasionally get individuals under the age of 16 who have committed unclassified and Class A felonies. It's really just the 16 and over that is designated as a waived minor. So we already have situations where we have youth that are charged with those types of offenses in our DJJ facilities. We truly believe that we provide our staff full information and training on adolescent development, trauma-informed care, understanding, just again, the adolescent mind. So even bringing in those 16-year-olds that have been charged with these types of offenses, I mean, we believe that security-wise, we can still manage those youth in an appropriate way. While we may not look the same as Department of Corrections, I do guarantee you we have a lot of safety and security practices in place. They are secure facilities. And yes, as far as the non-delinquent youth that we're talking about here that would be through OCS, I believe that, you know, in my opinion as director and knowing where kind of the JJDPA was going with this and providing even tighter guidelines, I think that's the federal side of things really recognizing that, yeah, we don't want to see, we don't want to make it easy for non-delinquent minors to be held in these secure facilities, and therefore that's why they're kind of tightening up and then creating, you know, just a few more extra guidelines under which the court has to make those findings for the non-delinquent youth to be held.
Senator Hughes.
And just as one more follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, can you explain to us, would there be a separation of what I might consider a more hardcore felon, even though I know their brain is still being developed and the rehabilitation, the education services, everything at DJJ are better for that minor than being in isolation in an adult facility, but would they be commingling with perhaps these short-term runaways, or how is it actually set up at these facilities?
Through the chair, to Senator Hughes, yes, there could be commingling. We do have, I mean, it's a detention facility, so it's pretty tight. It's a lot more, I think, safe. Well, I mean, all of our facilities are safe and secure, but certainly in the detention unit, there's educational programming that's being provided. Again, these youth, the non-delinquent youth that we would see through OCS, while, as Ms. Mead said, you know, there's circumstances under which they could be held for up to 7 days, they're usually in and out of our facilities pretty quickly. So there's not a lot of that opportunity for commingling, but you know, we're not locking anybody down in their rooms. We're usually keeping kids pretty busy and involved in either educational programming or other types of educational programming that we have in our facilities.
And I'll just make a comment in closing, not a question, Mr. Holland. Chair Holland, because I know you want to keep moving. But you know, especially even with the adult facilities, we've struggled when some low-level offenders are around they're harder core felons because those behaviors and things can rub off. And so my concern would be that we probably don't want them to commingle too much and get those runaways out of there as quickly as possible, which sounds like that's your goal. But children and young people and teenagers, they kind of rub off on one another. And I would hope that the good would rub off as well, and it would go both directions, but I'm just concerned if you have someone who's murdered someone, I don't want them influencing somebody that's being temporarily held until they're found another family to live with.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we're prepared for another topic in the bill?
I had questions on this part with her, Mr. Chairman.
I can wait.
Senator Schauer.
Just a brief follow-up, and we will address. I want to make sure we work with the department on this standalone bill, because this does reference everything we're discussing here, Mr. Chair, about separating, because obviously that is a concern. Any commingling at all is not just rubbing off, but also just the danger from what would I consider to be a predator, somebody that's very vulnerable, especially runaways. They're actually in that much more vulnerable category, and to put them in there, that's of high concern. So we need to figure out if there's a better way to do this, and I'll make sure that we address this next year with the standalone bill with whoever's going to actually introduce it. But I have concerns about that, and I think that should be on the record. Mr. Chair, we need to solve that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Thank you, Director Dumpling. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could ask maybe Mr. Davidson, maybe the director, to jump to the repealers at the back of the bill. I think the first two, if I remember them correctly, had to do with revoking driver's licenses. And it's not entirely clear to me what the impact of these repealing these two sections is on the division's flexibility to treat each case differently according to the kid's need. Can you talk to me about what exactly we're doing here?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'd be happy to address that. So, yes, Section 56 is the repealer section, and the first two repeals, Title 28 and Title 4712-060B5, deal with the mandate that DJJ repeal driver's licenses for minors who have been charged with a misconduct involving a controlled substance, let's say possession of marijuana, and their case is handled informally. So that's a holdover. Back in 2016, the legislature repealed the requirement that the division take away driver's licenses for similarly situated youth with similar charges who are adjudicated delinquent for those same offenses. And so this repealer just aligns those two penalties. Right now, the statute, the 4712-060B5, requires that the division seek the revocation of driver's licenses for a minor who possesses marijuana, and we don't pursue a court case around it. And so that's what the basis of what those repeals are. The flexibility, that the court still does have flexibility to appeal driver's licenses for those same offenses. If it does go to court, the court has the option to seek revocation of driver's license or to notify the Department of Motor Vehicles about the revocation of driver's licenses for adjudications dealing with misconduct involving weapons and misconduct involving controlled substances. This change just takes away the mandate that the division does it for informal cases. Those are the cases that we handle just in conversation with the family, and that they never go to court.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. So in those informal resolutions, does the division retain the ability, if a young person, your professional staff think this particular young person's a menace on the road, but you're going to handle the whole case, right? Multiple issues are pretty common. Do you retain the ability to take that driver's license in an informal resolution?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would say that we could seek that through a court process. But the statute that's being repealed here is the requirement that we do it for all cases involving misconduct involving controlled substances. I would be, for clarity for the committee, these are not offenses that had anything to do with driving. These are not driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. This is simple possession of a minor amount of a controlled substance in such a case that we would not seek an adjudication or any formal court processes. And so I'd say that the division still has the option to seek a more formal court order to repeal driver's licenses in all cases, and that occasionally occurs, especially when that penalty is appropriate.
Just final. Senator Q?
Thank you. So, but it sounds like in that situation, you would then no longer be doing an informal resolution of the case, right?
That's correct, sir.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Very quickly, do you anticipate any reduction or changes to recidivism amongst this population group that we're discussing here from this change? And then how much federal money does this change protect? Just those two quick questions. Thank you.
Through the chair to Senator Schauer, I just want to clarify, are you talking about the recidivism of waived minors?
That's correct. Do you anticipate any changes with this from this policy change?
Thanks for that clarification. I would like to think so, yes. I think that for those minors who are in DJJ facilities, they'll be required to participate in education. So our education programs with the partners that we have through all of our local school districts where we have facilities, they'll be required. It's not something I don't want to speak for Department of Corrections, but there's, I think, certain exceptions. You have to actually want to be involved in educational programming in Department of Corrections to participate, where in DJJ facilities they would be required. And we certainly know that education or lack thereof, basically is a criminogenic risk factor, both for minors and for adults. And so at the very minimum, helping them to move forward in their education, whether that's to hopefully get them their high school diploma before they turn age 18 or get their GED, I think it's one step in the right direction. And then if you could ask your second question again, because I've forgotten, sorry.
How much money, how much federal money does this protect, this change?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Schauer. So I'm just taking a look really quickly. Sorry, I'm on leave, so I'm calling and I'm trying to do this from separate iPads. So we are looking at, so the grant award that we received last fiscal year, this current fiscal year, was about $424,000. So a 20% penalty to that off the top, we're looking at about $85,000 if that award amount was to remain the same in the future. So at a minimum, $85,000. And then we have to take the remaining balance of that federal award and use 50% of it to then get us into federal compliance. So we would be looking at approximately, I believe, $225,000 remaining from that original $424,000 that we can actually continue to use through the Title II grant award for things that are not focused on getting ourselves in compliance with the JJRA and getting those waived minors out of DOC facilities.
Thank you, Director Dumpling. I also see Senator Begich in the audience. Senator Begich, I know you have some investment here. You have maybe SB 99 is involved in this. Do you care to come to the table and speak on it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tom Begich, Senate District J, downtown Anchorage. Just a couple of comments, and I think the members of the committee, or at least most of you know this, I was for 21 years, served on the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee for the state, also was the national chair of the Coalition for Juvenile Justice and worked on the revisions to the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act of 1974 in the 92 revisions, participated as well in the late 90s revisions, and participated in the early 2000 revisions of that legislation, including amending and adding it, and some of these provisions are spoken to. I wanted to just say two things, that the amount of federal funding that you're hearing now is based on last year's authorization and appropriated amounts from the Department of Justice to the states. Alaska gets a minimum amount. It's because of our size, our small size, where there's a base minimum that's given to each state. That amount under the current proposed budget of the administration is actually going to go up. So there will be more money, in fact, involved in this. In the past, as much as $750,000 has been directly connected to what are called the core requirements of the JJDPA Act that was referred to earlier. So one of those areas that the funding has gone to in the past has been to what are called non-attendant care shelters. These are grants that are provided to communities so that runaways actually don't go to detention facilities. It's an alternative for runaways that allows law enforcement to be freed up to be able to do their business instead of driving around with a status offender in the back of their vehicle or in some manner like that. So we had a number of those set up around the state. I'm not sure what the number is today, but that's something worth noting. I would add that I served on that committee and as chair of that committee here in the state under Governors Sheffield, Cooper, Hickel, Knowles, Murkowski, and Walker. So pretty wide division, and what we tried to do is create the best juvenile justice system in the country. And so this is part of that process, comporting the choice of supporting the division with SB 99, which is incorporated in House Bill 105, was to capture those provisions of federal law to ensure that the law passed in 2018 during the Trump administration would continue to keep us in compliance and not lose those funds so we could continue to provide these alternatives throughout the state of Alaska. But beyond that, nothing more to add.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Keel, do you have a question?
Not for Senator Begich, for the division.
Oh, Senator Begich, we may have a question for you from Senator Hughes.
Mr. Chair, because he's had so much experience, the idea of commingling someone, and you did mention that all efforts are not to have these runaways ending up, but if you have somebody that's lower level or is a runaway, what are your thoughts about these someone who maybe committed a murder being in the same facility and how that should be handled.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, Senator Begich, for the record. The way, when I worked with the division, I was an employee of the division, I was community justice director for a number of years. The way that the division trains its professional staff is to ensure that separation is maintained in an appropriate and safe manner. During the time that I worked at the division, there was no instance where that commingling led to further victimization, those kinds of things. So I'm not aware of any instance where that occurred during the time I was at the division. The whole point of developing the alternatives was first understanding that placement of juveniles within a, while they are in fact, that state of mind, that place of mind where their brain is still forming, placing them in a juvenile justice facility as opposed to an adult facility, whether they had committed the act of murder or not, was deemed to be a more appropriate placement because of their amenability to treatment. Mm-hmm. Those that were deemed unamenable to treatment were either automatically waived at the age of 16, and we passed automatic waiver in the state in 1991, or court has the jurisdiction or maintains the jurisdiction in cases of extreme culpability or non-amenable to treatment to waive those juveniles at even a younger age to adult, and we know of cases where that has occurred. So at present, I believe that the division is the best place for all of these juveniles to be at this point detained. And then further, that loss of the federal funds, which would eliminate significant levels of alternatives because we leveraged that money quite well, would actually create more risk, not less risk. So that's the dilemma we face here. Even though the numbers are small, you know, in the great scheme of billion-dollar budgets, they actually leverage significant amounts of significant levels of alternative to detention. So that's what my very long answer to your very short question would be.
And just a follow-up comment, because some of us were involved, I guess three of us were involved with the repeal of SB 91, and we talked about that being step one, step two being rehabilitation, and one of the visions a number of us had was, for instance, a location like Palmer Correctional Facility would be for just the low-level offenders with a tremendous effort on education and rehabilitation to try to give them a second chance at life, basically. So that's just that same concept for the young people, I think, is important. And so I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Just for the record, I may have been involved. I think I called my legislator.
If I might add.
Senator Begich.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, Senator Begich, for the record, one advantage of HB 105 is that you won't have to vote on an SB 91.
That's right. She was a yes for SB 91.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish I had as witty a question. I do, however, have one more on the bill. It's section 41 at page 27. And the division touched briefly on the goal here, but I'm not sure I understand all the implications of the language. Could we get a more detailed description of what those changes in E, so lines 22 to 25, what those are intended to do?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. Yes, I'm looking at page 27, section 41. The intent of this is in DJJ confidentiality statute in 4712.310. The intent of these changes are to clarify that the Division of Juvenile Justice can share appropriate information regarding a case or a minor with the Department of Corrections to facilitate the care, supervision, rehabilitation of those minors. The division, not on occasion, gets requests from the Department of Corrections. And so in this case, we want to be able to share information, medical information about minors who have maybe graduated from DJJ and then committed another offense and moved on to DOC. Sometimes, and we do have a We do have authorization to share what we call predisposition reports with DOC for classification purposes or other purposes. And so one intent here is to make sure that we can share appropriate information to allow for the Department of Corrections to adequately care for a former juvenile offender. The other change here is to clarify, to add corrections here, to make sure that we can share information about waived minors, but that is later on in the section. On page 28, we add a new section about sharing information on these this new class of waived minors that have been held in DJJ facilities temporarily pending their 18th birthday.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, and I think it's potentially very helpful, even and especially if we can get the Department of Corrections to transition to the model Senator Hughes was talking about for some of those offenders who can be rehabilitated. I'm curious about, I think, as I read this language, it does something else, though. I think somebody who's been through juvenile justice, graduated, as you said, I think all their records are available to law enforcement the way this is drafted now. Am I misreading that, and was that the intent?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would say that the intent is not to allow all juvenile records, nor is it written to allow all juvenile records. The standard of 4712.310b2e is where we're reading, is this: the state shall disclose appropriate information regarding a case, and then we read, a law enforcement or correction agency of this state or another jurisdiction as may be necessary for the protection, rehabilitation, care, or supervision of any minor or former juvenile offender, we add that, or for that action, for actions by that agency to protect public safety. So the division works, is very secure in its sharing of information, and we do not share information with law enforcement agencies about current minors willy-nilly, if you will. The standard is pretty tight, and I'd say the current example may be if we have an absconder or someone who goes AWOL from a facility, and we work with law enforcement to bring that minor back into custody, we do share information with law enforcement in that case. But the director might have other information about information sharing with law enforcement.
For the record, Tracy Dumpling, Director of Division of Juvenile Justice. Yeah, just to add to Matt, I mean, we certainly do. If they have information and we have information that we can share with law enforcement, because it is this heightened sense of public safety, they're trying to perhaps find somebody. We've given information in the past about tattoos. They were trying to identify someone, and they called us knowing that that individual had had a history with DJJ, and they were trying to help identify and kind of hone in that this was actually who they were looking for. So we do, under those circumstances, give that information. I think for this piece of kind of extending that information, sharing with Department of Corrections, is, as Senator Keel and even Senator Hughes has, you know, kind of alluded to, with just that ability. I like to call it kind of continuity of care, because in the DJJ system, we are more rehabilitative. We're looking at providing or finding someone to provide services to address the criminogenic risk factors that those minors have. And so for me, I see it as, why should Department of Corrections have to reinvent the wheel? It would be nice to be able to share that information with them. It does, in turn, in, you know, maybe a couple steps out, tie into public safety, because the better work that Department of Corrections probation officers can do with individuals in the community, knowing the intervention services, it maybe issues that we had with them at the Division of Juvenile Justice, it just kind of helps with that continuity of care to hopefully, rehabilitate that individual when they're an adult.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, and that's all as I said, that's an excellent intention for the former offenders who go into the Department of Corrections. And the description of the goal for those who are currently involved with DJJ and law enforcement also makes a lot of sense. I think the way this is written, whatever you got on former offenders in DJJ's files, if law enforcement asks, there's an or there, right? So for all those purposes, or for actions by the agency to protect public safety. So I wonder if we had an amendment that just split this the two notions into separate paragraphs, so we clarified that former offender information could go to corrections, and make no changes in what can go to law enforcement. Would that make sense?
I'm sorry, was there, Director Dumpling, did you have a comment? It didn't come across.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, that's fine. I mean, if that's what the committee thinks, you know, to help clarify, I don't necessarily see it as then in scope limiting what we would provide to law enforcement. It would still be the same that we provide now. It's just adding more to that ability to share corrections. But, you know, if the committee feels that it makes more sense to separate it, I don't think the division would have an objection to that.
Thank you, Director Dumpling. Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, I will open up public testimony at this time. Public testimony for HB 105 is now open. Does anyone in the room wish to provide public testimony? Seeing none. And does anyone online wish to provide public testimony? I see none there as well. So I'll close public testimony at HB 105. Are there any other comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I have a conceptual amendment.
The amendments, I'll get the amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
But no other comments at this time. And now it comes to the amendments questions. Are there any amendments? And just for simplicity's sake, I will lead with Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So bear with me. I think we've got this right here. I was struggling to try to make it the fastest amendment ever with just one word. Although if Senator Keel comes up with a two-letter word, I'm going to lose that battle today, so because mine has three letters in it. So, Mr. Chairman, I move conceptual amendment number one to House Bill 105, version G.
I will object to this most amenable amendment because it's the best conceptual amendment I've ever seen, but I will object for explanation.
Mr. Chairman, we've previously discussed it. It's on the record, so I'll just add what it is in Section 17. And it's page 12, Section 17. It's going to be line 30. After the semicolon, add the word and.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. I will remove my objection. Seeing no other objection, amendment number one is adopted. Are there any other amendments?
Mr. Chairman, could Senator I get Keel? A 30-second at ease?
A brief at ease. Good afternoon, Senate Judiciary Committee's back on the record. Senator Keel, an amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I move conceptual amendment two.
I will object for explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What conceptual amendment two would do is pull the or former juvenile offender language out of paragraph E there on page 27. And then create a new subparagraph, O, just at the bottom of the list, that allows for the correction or the information sharing about former juvenile offenders with the Department of Corrections as described by the administration. And the idea here is just to clarify that we're doing what the administration intended, but not more. We're not opening up the juvenile justice records of former offenders, young people who've done their rehabilitation plan and out, to sharing with law enforcement. We are only doing what the department has expressed they want to do with the bill.
Question. I see you've removed law enforcement from that was part of E that is not replicated in O, and I just wanted to make sure that was the intention or an oversight. A law enforcement or corrections agency of this state or another jurisdiction.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we wouldn't put law enforcement back in the new paragraph, because the new paragraph would be about the former offenders. So the department can share with corrections about the former offenders.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to ask this with the word and again popping up again, but because you changed it, just to make sure, since this is going to be O and under N, there was an and moving on to 3. Do you need to have an and after this for that amendment and strike the one before? How does that need to work for conforming?
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that legal services be allowed to make conforming and technical changes.
Works for me.
I would legislative legal make conforming and technical changes. I don't believe it affects 3 because 3 is actually, I don't know, does that affect 3? All right, is there any other discussion on conceptual amendment number 2? I will remove my objection. Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number 2? Oh, I'm sorry. Director Dompling?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a little bit of concern, I guess, just I wanted to point out that taking former DJJ offender out of the law enforcement piece, I'm a little concerned because that would mean that it would only be youth that were under DJJ's jurisdiction that law enforcement could call and ask a question about. So the example that I gave about law enforcement reaching out about a tattoo, that was actually a former, that person was no longer under DJJ's supervision. They were, you know, now an adult, and they were calling to seek clarification. And for those purposes, that would be, quote unquote, a former offender with DJJ. So I worry about removing that language. I just wanted to put that out there, that it might actually limit that scope instead of separating it out and saying just, you know, Department of Corrections can have information about former offenders too. By taking former offenders out of law enforcement, I really think it's going to shrink the information that we can share. But I just wanted to put that out there.
Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would restore the effectively the status quo for the law enforcement sharing piece. So in the situation Director Dompling describes, she would have under this amendment the authority she has today.
Director Dompling, do you have any comments on that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, would you mind just reading one more time what it would say for law enforcement so I can hear that? I just thought it was pulling the former offender piece out.
Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, so the result for paragraph E would be that it reads, so we're talking about, the agency shall disclose information. Appropriate information regarding a case to E. A law enforcement or corrections agency of this state or another jurisdiction, as may be necessary for the protection, rehabilitation, care, or supervision of any minor or for actions by that agency to protect the public safety. So we would remove the former juvenile offender there, but if that existing language allowed the information sharing Director Dompling described in the past, we're not taking away existing authority. We're only shifting the expanded authority to apply only to corrections.
Director Dompling?
Thank you, Mr. Yes, absolutely. Senator Keel, through the chair, you're correct. Thank you. And I also pulled it up on my other iPad because I was trying to make sure I was reading along with it. So you are correct. It just was the way it was stated initially that I had those concerns, but no other concerns. Thank you for allowing me to address that.
All right. So once again, my objection has been removed. Is there any other objection before the committee? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number 2 is adopted. there any more amendments? Seeing none, what is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 105, Work Order 32-GH1576-4/G, as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 105 has moved from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, there are no further meetings scheduled for the Senate Judiciary Committee during the 2021 session, and we are adjourned at 2:43 p.m.